From Cinderella to Miley Cyrus, our girls grow up in an environment rich in images of girls and women. This hour, the challenges of growing up female. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we're continuing our exploration of gender differences in our kids and the challenges they create. Yesterday, we talked about boys. Today, girls. We'll talk about gender differences and identity, how girls learn and why they're still underrepresented in scientific fields. We'll talk about dangers girls face as they grow and the challenges of navigating relationships and an influential media landscape. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we are continuing our conversation about gender differences in our kids and the different challenges faced by girls and boys. Yesterday, we talked about boys. Today, it's the girls' turn. This hour, we're going to talk about how kids learn about gender differences and how that influences their behavior. We'll also talk about how girls change as they grow, how they navigate relationships, learning styles that are specific to girls, and, of course, we'll also talk about how girls are influenced by media. We do want to hear from you with your questions and concerns. You can send us email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And my first guest today is Elaine Blakemore. She is a professor of psychology and associate dean of arts and sciences at Indiana University, Purdue University, Fort Wayne. The focus of her research is on gender development in children. Hello, Elaine.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today. And when you look at small children, what are some of the gender differences that we start to see develop in those very early years?
On average, boys and girls are more similar than they're different. Mm-hmm. But on average, boys engage in somewhat more aggressive behavior than girls do. Aggression, psychologists define as behavior intended to hurt or harm a person or object. So that might be kicking, hitting, pinching, hair pulling, as well as yelling, insulting. It could be verbal or physical aggression. So on average, boys engage in somewhat more aggression than girls do. They also engage in more what's called rough and tumble play, you know, having fun, play fighting, running around chasing, pretend attacking, those sorts of things. Girls have, as they develop social interactions, and tend to use more reciprocal interactions, less hierarchical. By hierarchical, I would mean somebody's in charge telling other people what to do in a very direct way, whereas reciprocal would be sort of more mutual, face-to-face sorts of interactions. There are also differences in children's interests. On average, boys are more interested in certain kinds of what you might call masculine stereotype toys, particularly vehicles, toys that move, and toys that involve violence. And girls are more interested in a lot of appearance-related toys, Barbie dolls, things of that nature, American Girl dolls. Somewhat more interested, perhaps, in domestic or household types of activities and toys. Boys may be more interested in certain kinds of building toys, but you're looking at average differences that don't necessarily apply to everyone.
When do kids start to have a concept of gender?
Okay, there are, that's a little easier question to answer than the other one. There are a variety of different concepts of gender that children might have. The very first one might be what gender they are. Am I a boy or am I a girl? Or that there are two. Usually children come to reliably answer the question, are you a boy or a girl, somewhere from 2 to 2.5. But that doesn't mean that they have all the conceptions that exist about gender. They may not be at all aware that women are the same category as girls. They may think that there are four different categories and that they're not necessarily related. That, yes, I'm a boy, but I might grow up to be a mommy and not, you know, think of that as unusual. So that's something we call gender stability, the idea that girls typically grow up to be women and boys grow up to be men. That's usually not maybe acquired till children are four or five. And then there's another concept about gender called gender constancy, which is the knowledge that gender is permanent, stable, and dependent upon biology or genitals. Yes, I'm a girl. I will always be a girl. I'm a girl because of having been born with a certain set of biological structures, and what I do, where, or activities I take part in don't make me not a girl. For example, young children, if you ask young children, you know, here's a girl doll, if this girl doll was to dress up in these very strongly masculine clothes, is she still a girl or is she now a boy? And young children will say, now she's a boy. They have no idea that these things don't change.
I've also, just in my own experience with kids, noticed that they are very drawn to patterns and trying to pick out patterns that govern their world. At what point do kids start to try to assign gender roles and pick up on some of the patterns that they see around them with regard to gender?
Somewhere between 2 and 4, you see the first beginnings of that. Children may have relatively rigid ideas about gender, even as relatively young children. They may insist that boys cannot do, like, wear nail polish, that, you know, it's like a law handed down from the sky or something, that they can't do these things. So you see the first sort of beginnings of children assigning toys, clothing, activities, and so on. Some are usually around 3.
In your research, have you observed changes because of how we interact with girls as opposed to how we tend to interact with boys?
I'm going to answer a somewhat different question, sorry, first. There is research showing biological influences on children's interest in toys in particular and in play styles like rough and tumble play styles.
Mm-hmm.
And probably we don't have time to go into the ins and outs of it, but there is a certain condition that some girls have that involves high levels of exposure to androgens prenatally, androgens being masculinizing hormones. Those girls typically have more masculinized play interests. That's one piece of evidence that suggests that prenatal hormone exposure influences some of these gender-related behaviors. So it's important to recognize that those influences have been documented.
Mm-hmm.
It's also the case that some research has been done on monkeys, showing that male monkeys have less interest in baby dolls than female monkeys do and more interest in vehicles than female monkeys do. And they're obviously not learning that by watching television.
Right.
Whatever. In terms of evidence to show that children's exposure to, say, media ads or toy packages or parental socialization or even more likely peer socialization influences gender-related play, that research exists as well. To give you one example, one of the things that boys and girls clearly do is they're worldwide drawn to peers of the same gender as they are. In the preschool period, but particularly notable in early elementary school, boys wanting to play largely with other boys and girls largely with other girls. They do that more in the absence of adults than in the presence, and there's very little evidence that adults are shaping that very much. It's mostly driven by the peer group in general. But some children are more likely to play solely with their own gender, and other children are more likely to have mixed gender interactions. If you look in a preschool setting where there's a a choice. Some boys like only hang around with boys, and others have a variety of friends. And what this research did is then follow those children over some longitudinal period. I can't say exactly how long, but let's say at least a year. And the more that children hang around or have peer relationships only with children of their gender, the more stereotyped in their play they become. And you can see that stereotyping increasing over that period of time. Whereas if they have more mixed gender interactions, their interests are not as, and their play styles are not as stereotyped over time. So what you're seeing is sort of a direct influence of who you play with on how gendered you become. There's evidence that boys who are somewhat behaviorally under control, like they're kids who are impulsive or maybe temperamentally difficult, the more they play with boys, the worse they become. Whereas if in those temperamental, difficult, under control sorts of ways, whereas if they play with girls, they tend to improve over time. This is one of the reasons why temperamentally difficult girls who have, you know, say 2-year-olds or 3-year-olds, improve over time, is that the more you play with girls, the more those behaviors are likely to get better. And girls are more likely to be playing with girls a lot, which is the reason why they're getting better.
That's fascinating. And the fact that children tend to segregate themselves.
Yes, they do tend to segregate themselves. And they probably do so for a variety of reasons, play styles being one of them. That I talked about, the rough and tumble play style that's more characteristic of boys. It, again, is one of the really notable differences in the way that little boys versus little girls interact. And doesn't apply to all kids. Some girls like rough and tumble play and some boys don't. And so one of the things that seems to be driving that gender segregation is being attracted to other kids who play like that versus shying away from it. It seems to be one of the things that the gender segregation actually starts somewhere around the age of 2, and it starts predominantly with girls avoiding boys, even though by the time that you get to elementary school, boys are driving it more strongly. They're, you know, really being the who you play with gender police, if you know what I mean. They don't want any boys to be playing with girls, or they're more likely to enforce those boundaries. But in the very beginning with really young children, it's girls who are avoiding boys, and they're avoiding them predominantly because they're not at all attracted to the rough and tumble play styles.
Elaine, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome.
Elaine Blakemore is a professor of psychology and the associate dean of arts and sciences at Indiana University, Purdue University, Fort Wayne. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're continuing our exploration of gender differences in our children and some of the challenges that can create. Yesterday, we talked about boys. Today, we're talking about girls. And with me now is Suzanne Friedman. She's a professor in the College of Education at the University of Northern Iowa. She was on the program yesterday to talk about boys, and she's back again today. Hello, Suzanne.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for coming back today.
My pleasure.
And let's talk again about adolescence. And yesterday you gave us a lesson in some of the changes that children's brains go through in adolescence. And I know that a lot of that is true for both boys and girls. So just give us a little bit of a refresher about some of the things that are happening in our kids' brains as they grow into adolescence.
Well, that's a good question. And as I said yesterday, we see a lot of transitions. Hormones are raging, but both boys and girls are experiencing a lot of more pressure in their lives. They are changing schools. They have different friendship roles, more responsibility at home, more teachers. So they have to manage a lot more in their life. They're also becoming involved in activities. And I think at this age, girls are really aware of the messages that society is giving them about what it means to be a girl, what it means to be a female.
Yes, and we are going to get into that conversation in just a couple of minutes as we focus on media and how girls navigate relationships in upper elementary and beyond. We talked yesterday about some of the things that are happening in brains, and we do tend to focus on hormones. And, of course, girls in their teen years are going through puberty. There are a lot of hormones surging through their systems. I think we blame a lot of things on hormones, but how much of a role does that play in behavior?
Well, it plays a role, but it's not, I mean, if it was a majority role, then we'd see all girls going, you know, crazy. And we know that that's not true. I mean, some girls, you know, manage very well through the period of early adolescence and adolescence, and some don't. So it's definitely there, the hormones, but other things play into, you know, part as well. I think it's important that, you know, we talk to our girls and our boys about what's happening to their bodies. We give them information. We let them know that we're available as parents, teachers sometimes, to answer their questions about, you know, what's happening, why they feel, you know, could feel so happy one moment and then, you know, so angry or, you know, just so sad. I have a 12-year-old girl and I've seen a lot of changes in her behavior over the, you know, the past few years in terms of more up and down emotions. You know, I sometimes refer to her as Dr., you know, Jekyll and Hyde, where she could be very sweet. And the next minute, I'm not sure who she is or where she came from. So hormones play a part, but other things are going on, too.
And we talked yesterday a little bit about the difference between when girls go through puberty and when boys go through puberty. And we tend to think that girls mature faster.
They do. They're going through puberty. They could, you know, start almost, you know, 2 years before we see changes in boys in terms of puberty. But boys, when they start, it takes longer, too. So girls, you know, start earlier and go through puberty more quickly, where boys start a little bit later and it takes longer.
And we also talked yesterday, I think this is an important reminder, especially with girls, because they do go through puberty a little bit earlier, and then they tend to look very adult. By the time they're in high school, we look at these young women, they look very adult, but their brains are not the brains of adults.
Definitely not. The frontal lobe is the last part of the brain to develop, and that might not occur until age 25, and that controls decision-making, responsibility sometimes, impulsiveness. And we need to remember, even though a girl may look physically mature, emotionally and cognitively, she is not.
There's one more contrast I want to draw before I let you go, and that's yesterday we talked about how, and again, we're talking in stereotypes, they're not 100% true, but more boys tend to identify themselves by what they do. Perhaps that's a sport, perhaps that's something else in their lives. Where do girls tend to find their identity?
Well, a lot of girls find their identity in their relationships. And, you know, they define themselves about who they are in relationship to other people. What was the name of that book? How to Be a Complete Woman Without a Man. I mean, that's as adult older individuals. But it kind of says we don't want our girls just defining themselves based on whether they're a girlfriend or a best friend or a daughter. I mean, those are important roles, but we also want them to see themselves for what they can do well, what they're interested in, what they want to do in their future. And that's changing as more and more women are entering the workforce and girls are focusing more on activities. But traditionally, it's girls based their identity on relationships.
Right. And as we talked about in the last segment of the show, it's impossible, especially as girls get older, to separate what is societal and what may be biological.
That's true. And my friend has a bumper sticker, or she used to, that said, question gender. And I think that's great for people to see that we could start to question, what does it mean to be a boy? What does it mean to be a girl? Can girls play football? I know some girls who play flag football. Is it okay if, you know, boys wear pink or purple or have earrings or, you know, cook? Mix it up a little bit.
Well, Suzanne, thank you so much for talking with me again today.
Thank you, Charity.
Suzanne Friedman is a professor in the College of Education at the University of Northern Iowa. Also yesterday on our program when we were talking about boys, we talked about the growing gap in education. Now, at this point in time, girls are graduating from high school at significantly higher rates than boys. They're graduating from college at significantly higher rates than men. Women are. But one area where women are still behind is going into scientific fields. Jeffrey Weld is the executive director of the Governor's STEM Advisory Council. That STEM stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
So do we know why girls are, with how education has changed over the last couple of decades, and in some ways it seems to be working better for girls, our system at this point, than it is for boys, why are girls still behind in this arena?
In their pursuits of scientific fields, yeah. It's a high priority, I'm happy to say, for the STEM Council to diversify the STEM pipeline. So we've looked at it closely, and we're administering some programming to try and ameliorate the imbalance. But it's probably worth just a minute to parse the STEM fields discussion a little bit. Women in the STEM fields have made great gains in the biological sciences, for example. The number of women majoring in biological sciences across the country outnumber the number of men, for example. In chemistry, almost an even balance, 50-50. Mathematics approaches an even balance of 50-50, and certain graduate programs, med school is now more percentage women than men, vet school, more women than men. So great gains have been made. Physics and engineering, considerable lags. I think the most recent statistic I saw was 26% of engineering majors across the country are women. So we've got a lot of work to do there. It is increasing incrementally. It's kind of vexing what a challenge that has been. And then most vexing of all is computer science. In this era of technology, we're really challenged to draw more young women into the computer science fields, and that number is actually declining since the turn of the century.
So in those specific fields, physics, engineering, computer science, do we have an understanding of why girls don't seem to be attracted to those fields?
Well, there's certainly no shortage of study and analysis and reporting, and a lot of earnest programming taking place here in Iowa as well as across the country to reverse those numbers. But it's a multifactorial answer, I suppose. It can be attributed to American media. It certainly can be attributed to curriculum and teacher practices. Certainly parents are part of the equation, as are girls themselves, and how they perceive of the fields of physics and engineering and computer science as worthwhile or not for their own pursuits.
Now, when I was in high school a couple of decades ago, more than a couple of decades ago, you know, there was a lot of emphasis on women in science and engineering because of this massive inequity at the time. Now that graduation rates have shifted and girls seem to have caught up and perhaps even surpassed boys in school in some ways, how has your program shifted? Because, of course, we need more students in just more students, period, in all of these fields.
That's exactly right. And diversifying the STEM pipeline is a necessary charge to this council because we foresee an increasingly diverse Iowa population. And unfortunately, underrepresented minorities are proportionally less likely to pursue advanced study in the STEM fields as the majority white population. So by a talent pipeline reason alone, we've got to find some tactics that are more recruiting and more magnetic to draw diverse representation into the STEM pipeline, including women. As I think one of your speakers cited so accurately, young girls are getting better grades than boys in math and science classes, but they're not opting for math and science and technology majors at the post-secondary level. So we know they can, and we know that it's an interest, not an ability question. And so most of the activity around the STEM Council has been to impact interest and try to drum up awareness opportunities for young girls to entertain advanced coursework, college preparatory trajectories in the so-called STEM fields. So we've got some media tactics, some curricular tactics, teacher training tactics, quite a suite of programming taking place.
All right, Jeffrey, thank you so much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
Jeffrey Weld is Executive Director of the Governor's STEM Advisory Council. STEM stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. And now I want to turn our conversation to relationships. Jane Ballvance is an elementary school counselor in Iowa City and the co-owner and writer for A Way Through. It's an organization that gives parents and educators tools to guide girls through hurtful friendships and social situations. Jane, thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Thanks, Charity. I'm glad to be here. And I also want to mention that I'm the school counselor at Kate Wickham Elementary.
And Jane, there we were talking about how girls tend to define themselves through relationships. Mm-hmm. And in upper elementary school, when girls are 10, 11, 12, this seems to become even more important mm-hmm. to them. What kinds of changes are you seeing at that time?
Well, the developmental task is to be a little more connected at that time. Girls start connecting at a very young age, but around this time, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, it becomes really important to connect, to not stand out, you know, just to be just like everybody else. So that's what I see happening there.
You have a wonderful image to describe how friendships work, and you describe girls' friendships at this age as kind of like a lava lamp.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me how that works.
That's the visual. I mean, I'm a very visual person, and when I see a lava lamp, that's kind of like girls' relationships. Okay, I'm going to stick with this one, and I'm going to stick forever, but ooh, that's a little nicer. So you break away. That changes that grouping of that bubble, and it changes the whole thing. So some other girls go off and group with somebody else. And that's what it's like in girl world.
Now, one of the things that you focus on with your organization, A Way Through, mm-hmm. and as a school counselor,
yes,
I'm sure,
yes.
as well, is relational aggression. And mm-hmm. relational aggression is not limited to girls,
no,
of course.
Definitely
but
not.
It does tend to be more prevalent mm-hmm. among girls. What is relational aggression for people who don't know?
It's a type of bullying that ruins somebody's social standing. And it's just bullying through relationships.
Okay. And can you give me an example?
Okay. If I'm a girl and I don't like another girl because she's taken away my friends, I'm going to try to change their relationship to her. For example, I'm going to start a rumor. Maybe I'm going to lie about her because I want my friends back. So if they can present the other girl like, not as nice as you think she is, plant a seed of doubt. That's an example of relational aggression.
Well, and you write about how a lot of girls in our society are socialized to be nice.
Yes.
Which is an important thing.
Yes.
But this socializing girls to be nice and to place such an emphasis on that mm-hmm. makes them vulnerable as well. Tell me why
it
that
does.
Is.
Well, first of all, we don't define to girls what nice is. What is it to be nice? And so they can kind of make up their own mind what they think they're supposed to do. Now, it's great to be nice. It's good to be civil. A lot of times when these nice girls go against somebody who's not so nice or, you know, have a little more power, they're left speechless. Their amygdala holds their thinking hostage. What do we do next? Because they haven't been taught to set boundaries. What do you do besides being nice? Well, I was nice to her. She still doesn't like me. She's still mean. So that's where girls need to be taught to have boundaries.
All right, and that is the focus of your curriculum for mm-hmm. A Way Through, is teaching mm-hmm. girls to stand up for themselves and
right.
how to navigate
right.
those very, mm-hmm. very tricky situations.
Yes. Yeah, because they always have choices. And we give them about 12 different choices that they can try if they have friendship problems, whether it's conflict, whether it's bullying. Girls don't like to be direct. Some girls do. But when they're in that connective phase, they want to stay connected at all costs. So they'll withstand some things from friends that they should set boundaries about. The connection probably around 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, that connection is so important. It actually releases more dopamine, and I can't remember the other hormones. But that is so pleasurable to girls, to be connected. The only thing that's more pleasurable that trumps that is orgasm. Mm-hmm. So you can see how important that is for girls. That's why they travel to bathrooms in groups. You know, it's to connect. It's not really to use the bathroom.
I think a lot of people have suspected that
for
a very long time. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to return to the conversation. Jane Ballvance is an elementary school counselor at Kate Wickham Elementary in Iowa City. She's also the co-owner of A Way Through, an organization that gives parents and educators tools to guide girls through hurtful friendships and social situations. We'll talk more about relationships and how girls have to navigate these relationships, how they're influenced in how they form relationships by society, and we're also going to turn our attention to media images of young girls, of women, are everywhere. What do they tell girls about themselves? Meenakshi Durham is a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Iowa. She'll be with us in just a moment as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about girls. Yesterday on Talk of Iowa, we talked about raising boys in our society. Today, the focus is on girls. And with me right now is Jane Ballvance. She's an elementary school counselor at Kate Wickham Elementary in Iowa City and the co-owner of A Way Through, an organization that gives parents and educators the tools to guide girls through hurtful friendships and social situations. Also joining me now is Meenakshi Gigi Durham. She is a professor with a joint appointment in the School of Journalism and in the Department of Gender, Women's, and Sexuality Studies at the University of Iowa. Welcome back to the show, Gigi.
Thanks for having me on, Charity.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I also want to invite you to join the conversation as well. If you have questions about how media influences society, how girls navigate friendships, give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, and you can tweet us at IPR Talk. And yesterday on the show, Gigi, we did talk about how media images and video game images, all of those things out there affect boys. So today we're going to talk about girls, and the media landscape strikes me as an observer as very different for young women. There are so many images of girls and women on television, on magazines. From your perspective, describe this landscape that, that our girls are experiencing.
Well, you're right. There are a range of images of women and girls. They're pervasive. They're everywhere. And actually, maybe I shouldn't have even used the word range, because there's a proliferation of images, but they don't actually range very much. There's a very sort of narrowly defined and very homogenous representation of femininity and female sexuality that girls are exposed to. And so it actually defines girlhood and womanhood very, very narrowly for girls and women.
And this starts very, very early in the lives of our girls.
It really does, yeah, because even media that are targeted to very young girls have the same sorts of representations, the same sorts of embodiments, and the same sorts of gender roles.
Let's talk about princesses.
Yeah,
because of course, that's one of the first things that our many of our girls are drawn to. It's one of the things that we love to show them and share with them. When they're looking at those Disney princesses, what are they seeing?
Well, so they're seeing very traditional gender roles, in the sense that in many Disney cartoons and stories, the princess is incomplete without the prince, you know. So if you think of a film like Aladdin, for example, I mean, Jasmine's whole all of the controversies in her life, everything about her life is revolves around her marriage, her impending marriage, either to a bad guy or a good guy, to Aladdin. And so it sort of also relates in a way to what Jane was saying, which is that girls are defining themselves through their relationships. And that's what's happening in most of these Disney cartoons. They're also exposed to a very problematic, I think, ideal of the feminine body, which is an extremely thin body that's at the same time very voluptuous. And it's right. a body that's
very tiny waist.
Right. Mm-hmm. Tiny waist, very thin, but, you know, also with, you know, enormous breasts and, you know, very, very voluptuous at the same time, which is a body not found in nature, really. People who tend to be very thin lose weight everywhere. And so they don't have that sort of look. So it's the same, but it's the exact same body that's portrayed in most advertising, you know, in sort of Abercrombie and Fitch, Victoria's Secret. It's the same body that you see on most reality shows. It's a body that can only be achieved through artificial means and, you know, through borderline starvation and plastic surgery. And I think that's a very problematic type of ideal to be presenting to girls as the desirable body.
Now, mm-hmm. when a little girl is looking at a princess, I mean, she sees the dress, she sees the sparkles,
right.
she sees the hair, she sees yep. the crown. How influential do you think the body is at that point?
Actually, it's tremendously influential. There was a very interesting dissertation study done quite recently that showed that when preschool girls were exposed to images of Disney princesses, they developed a significantly lower body image than when they were exposed, say, to another type of Disney cartoon like Fantasia, which, as I recall, had dancing hippopotamuses in it or something like that. Hippopotami? Anyway. So it actually does impact them. You know, there are direct effects.
Now, of course, as girls grow, the images that they are drawn to mm-hmm. and that are presented to them change a little bit. But let's talk about the media landscape for a girl in, let's say, upper elementary school. What kinds of things are out there?
Well, you know, again, I don't think it's a very, well, actually, this is interesting to me. Girls at that age and at every age are still exposed to the same types of images I was talking about. They walk through the mall, they see Victoria's Secret posters. They, you know, if they're on newsstands, they're going to see Glamour and Cosmopolitan and Shape right. and things. I mean, you know, so it's very difficult for girls to avoid those sorts of representations because they really are everywhere. At the same time, I think there are media targeted to girls, in elementary school, you know, basically from about kindergarten through sixth grade, that are actually more progressive. So there are, you know, there are girls like Ramona. there are girls on PBS shows like Dragon Tales. And those girls, and Dora the Explorer, whom I think is wonderful for all sorts of different reasons, including the fact that she's bilingual and that she goes off on adventures by herself. And so I think there are some really strong positive images and representations of girls in some children's media.
I want to, and Jane, I want to bring you mm-hmm. into this conversation as well. While there are wonderful things out there, one of the things that I have noticed and been a little disturbed by, and I've been spending a lot of time with girls between the ages of 8 and 12 right now mm-hmm. in the recent weeks, but there are these sitcoms that are geared toward tweens and teens, and they're all about school and often about girls, especially who are in school and are also pop stars mm-hmm. for whatever reason. But these shows, I've watched a couple of them and find that the social construct is so heavily stereotyped on these shows. And I look at that and I think, well, I don't think that reflects reality. But then I spend time with these girls and I hear them talking the same way and repeating the same things mm-hmm. that they hear on these shows. How much are these artificial social constructs then coming back into schools and influencing how girls are treating each other?
About 98%.
So a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And especially the reality shows. I don't watch reality shows because I don't like them, mainly because they show people being mean to each other, you know, and mm-hmm. I don't even know the names of them, but voting people off islands and stuff, you have to be mean to people. So, you know, think about parents sitting down with their kids watching reality shows and isn't this nice, isn't this adventurous? But the kids learn how to treat each other that way. It's okay. They do it on TV. It's harmful.
Mm-hmm. And if I can jump in on yeah. that, some of the sitcoms that you're referring to that are targeted to teen girls, early adolescents, some of the Disney shows, for example, or Nickelodeon shows, They also embody a certain type of representation of the female body that's the same image. They're still very, very thin. Most of them are Caucasian. Most of them have sort of long flowing curls. You know, if even if they're ethnic minorities, they have very fine features. And so you don't see a range of characteristics that might be, you know, that might represent diverse racial groups. You don't see darker skin tones. You don't see, you know, broader noses or, you know, curlier hair, things like that. So again, it's a very, very narrowly defined body type that's being presented there.
So how do you teach a girl to navigate this media landscape and think critically about what she's seeing?
So the first thing, and I'm sure Jane would agree with this, is keep the lines of communication open, right? Talk to them a lot about this stuff, and that can start very, very early. I have a whole lot of things like this in my book, The Lolita Effect, a lot of strategies that parents can use to help girls navigate this media landscape. But one is, it's never too early to start talking to them about these images. Like even when I have two daughters, and when they were really little, we would watch Disney or something, and I would say, do you really think that anybody could breathe with a waist that tiny? Do you really think she could stand up on legs that thin? They look like spaghetti noodles. And I would, you know, sort of offer a critical perspective. A lot of times they would just start laughing and say, no, I don't think anybody could actually breathe if they looked like that. You know, things like that, just to help them kind of begin to know that it's okay to critique. And it's then that there is a difference between fiction and fantasy. I mean, fiction and fact, rather.
And I'm curious, and I'd love both of you to share your opinions on this. You know, as we see these images, of course, we naturally compare ourselves to those mm-hmm. images. But when I think back about my own personal body image problems, when I had many growing up, so much of my insecurity came from what people said to me, not from what I saw, but it didn't have to be someone necessarily that influential in my life saying something to me. It could be this girl said this and I, you know, a friend of mine heard it and she told me that she said this. I mean, what seems to carry the most weight in how we think about ourselves?
Do you want to take this one?
Well, I was just thinking my own personal experience where I think I was a pretty good size for my, you know, growing up years. And then I got to be around 10 years old and I was told I was pleasingly plump. There had been a change, and pleasingly sounds good, but what the heck is that other stuff? So that kind of stuck with me. And that was in fourth grade. By sixth grade, 2 years later, I was 5'2", 91 pounds, which is very small, but I considered myself huge.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it just the most benign thing that somebody could say, and even out of love, no, you're not fat, you're pleasingly plump. So, you know, you can kind of tell the difference there. I would talk to girls about being healthy, not about what their shape looks like.
Right.
Yeah. I think peer pressure is really, really influential, though. I did a 5-month ethnographic study of girls in a middle school, and they were constantly policing each other's bodies. She should not wear stripes, you know, things like that. And they were, but a lot of it was drawn from these media representations. They were comparing their own bodies and other bodies with the images they were seeing. So we all live in this media-saturated environment, and it affects our relationships with each other and the way people talk to each other.
Peggy is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Peggy.
Hi.
Hi. What did you want to talk about?
Well, ironically, I just got back from visiting my 21-year-old daughter in Brooklyn, New York, where she goes to college, and she had me watch the documentary called Misrepresentation, mm-hmm. which is, it just is phenomenal, mm-hmm. and I have provided that information to other people, particularly with younger girls and women. And it really connected for her a number of things. One, how I was raised by a mother who, you know, looks for everything, and I was chubby, and we had to go to the chubbies. But then how it really struck me how the deregulation of TV really increased, I'm not sure deregulation is correct, but it increased the number of shows and all those opportunities to provide more violence and more sexuality on TV.
Thanks so much for bringing that up, Peggy, and the documentary she's talking about, Misrepresentation, came out a couple of years ago, but it's been making the circuits. I think it's on Netflix, and it explores media's misrepresentations of women and how that has influenced women as they grow. There have been things like that. It strikes me, Gigi, maybe you have a better handle on it, but it strikes me there have been more things like that in recent years, a backlash against these media representations of women that are so unrealistic. And I just saw an interview with Jennifer Lawrence, who's in the Hunger Games movies, and she was talking about all the pressure on her to diet and how she rejected that. I mean, yes, we see Miley Cyrus, but we're also seeing these other strong women talking about themselves and standing up for themselves. Do you think there's been an increase in that kind of thing lately, Gigi?
I think there are more discourses of that sort. I mean, I think you are hearing more critical voices in the media. It's really interesting to me to hear about that. I mean, of course, the media are sort of a contested terrain. I mean, we have shows like this, for example. We're the media, too.
Right.
We're offering this critical perspective right here on Talk of Iowa. At the same time, it's very interesting to me to do analyses of things like women's magazines, where there will be an article that says something like, love your body, right? And it'll be endorsing all of these, you know, feminist perspectives. But the whole rest of the magazine has the same kinds of thin, voluptuous bodies. And, you know, half of it'll be about losing weight and dieting and, you know, plastic surgery and using cosmetics to, you know, to achieve a certain type of supermodel look and so on. And so there's contradictions right there that give girls and women such mixed messages about this stuff. It's confusing.
Well, and there also, when you look in clothing sections of stores, there does seem to be this sexualization of young girls at younger and younger ages.
Yes.
Sexy clothing being
Absolutely.
Sold, sexy Halloween costumes
That's
being
right.
sold
That's right. Yeah.
to children. So I know you're a mother, you've done research about this, you've written a book about it. With these things that look attractive, the makeup with the hair, the nail polish, all of that stuff, you don't want to say, no, you can't do any of that stuff, because then you create an environment where your daughter has something new to rebel against. How, again, do you help a girl navigate that landscape where there are so many people trying to sell her things to change how she looks?
Yeah, so that's absolutely true. And no, you can't just deny her all of that. You know, then it'll make her a complete social outcast and cause more unhappiness and rebellion, as you're saying. So I think the thing to do is to try to work towards balance, right? I mean, because there is a pleasure in painting your nails or putting on makeup, whatever people like to look attractive. And so I think everything within balance. I think the important thing that we do is try not to create one-dimensional girls whose only value for themselves is their appearance, right? So we have to encourage them to do other things as well, to enjoy sports, to enjoy other activities, art, whatever it is they like, to praise them for things other than just their appearance, you know, to make sure that they understand that their accomplishments are a wonderful part of who they are too. So if they're, you know, if they're talented at math, if they have scientific aptitudes, if they have a great community spirit and they do volunteer work, you know, there are so many different aspects of girls that, you know, they're complex human beings. And so I think if we value all of those different aspects of who they are and not just focus on their appearance, that's going to be really good for them. It counters the media message that appearance is the only thing that matters.
And Jane, you're also helping girls learn how to stand up for themselves and be assertive.
Yes. We have a strategy, which is the speak up readiness approach. And in that, we actually show kids how to stand up straight, look a person straight in the eye, use a just right voice, not too loud, not too soft. And their goal is to make the problem smaller instead of bigger. So that's actually practice and learning how to do that.
All right. And that sounds important for boys and girls.
Yes, definitely.
All right. Jane Ballvance, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Jane Ballvance is an elementary school counselor at Kate Wickham Elementary in Iowa City and the co-owner of A Way Through. Gigi Durham, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Meenakshi Gigi Durham is a professor with a joint appointment in the School of Journalism and in the Department of Gender, Women's, and Sexuality Studies at the University of Iowa. If you're interested in listening to our show about boys yesterday, you can go to our website, iowapublicradio.org. Talk of Iowa is produced by Sarah Bowden, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Tony Daner. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow it's Horticulture Day. This is Talk of Iowa.